Hey guys, today we've got Barry Hawkins with us, who is a product development specialist. Now, what this means is that he stewards the creation process and enables those he works with to feel empowered and collaborative, even on teams with hundreds, if not thousands of people. He has worked on some really, really cool projects, including the replay system in League of Legends at Riot. He's also worked at Hulu, although that stuff is a little bit more top secret. And just overall, he was a super kind, caring, empathetic person. I enjoyed making this episode so much, and I hope that you enjoy watching it. If you have any questions, as always, please feel free to leave them in the comments below, and we will get back to you quickly and answer your questions. And if you like this kind of content, like and subscribe for more. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hi guys, how are you doing today?
Doing all right.
Hey, doing well. Thank you.
Yeah.
Today we are lucky to be joined by Barry Hawkins.
Hello there, everyone.
Barry Hawkins has been a producer at a bunch of major studios. He's worked at Blizzard. He's worked at Riot. You've actually worked at a few other very, very major names. Would you like to go ahead and run us through some of those?
Sure. I am one of those odd birds in game development who has lived in both the game development world and other sectors of entertainment. I guess the ones people recognize the most are Netflix and Hulu as far as streaming TV. But then also in the mainstream and less storied world of traditional software product development in the mobile and web, usually distributed application and service spaces.
That's a big variety. So at all of these places, what is it that you do?
Sure. I do what some studios would call production, which is managing the work systems of the game development teams for both the engineering, design, and art. And in the other settings, it's doing a similar job of managing the work of n number of teams and bringing everything together such that the schedule, goals, all the things line up when they need to so that we can make the things and get the monies.
Awesome. So it's very much a leadership position.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people coming into this podcast, especially having listened to game designers and artists before this, might kind of be taken aback at that
Absolutely.
At first. But the simple truth is that when you're making a fun game, the quality of what you can deliver is defined by both the budget and the time budget you have for the product, right? And so working with producers, especially very effective producers, is incredibly important for making sure you can develop the game to the best of your abilities, right? Now, I know you've done a lot of higher level organizational stuff. Are there any particular features or things you've been close to or part of that you'd like to talk about a little bit to kind of like connect people to how the work you do is connected to the work a game designer or an artist does?
Absolutely. In terms of features and things that I've worked on League of Legends from Riot Games, and I guess I can talk about some of the things that didn't see the light of day. But the replay system was one thing. Most of what happened with the player behavior initiative from 2012 to 14, starting with commendations and the rework and international launch of the Tribunal, all the way into Team Builder, I think is what we ended up calling it after much debate and rigmarole. The Howling Freljord, some other major content and game mode releases for League. And then at Blizzard Entertainment, I worked on World of Warcraft, which is one of my favorite games of all time. And there I worked on I came in right in the midst of full-on production for the Warlords of Draenor expansion. Don't hate me for Garrisons. You should have seen what Garrisons was going to be before production got involved. But pre-production for Legion. But along the way there, taking on the at the time somewhat stalled out WoW token project, for those who are familiar when that entered that particular game world. So those are most of the features where I could concretely tie like me actually doing individual contributor or team level work, and not just being a leader of something like at, you know, say like Hulu, where it was you know, an 800 person product org where I had 30 reports in my org alone, and yeah, and all the other people. So yeah.
You said don't hate me for Garrisons, but I was never a big World of Warcraft player. Why would I hate you for Garrisons? What happened with that?
Well, so Alex can speak more eloquently. So I'll start with my brutish layman producer speak. People generally, folks have felt that it was, we were trying to bring RTS like gameplay loops into an MMO, and we tried too hard. We put too much in. What it took to get to the fun of Garrisons was just generally not super well received. So when I talk about having been involved in Warlords of Draenor, one of the first things that I usually hear about is, oh, so Garrisons, right? Yes, it's good to meet you too. So that's me. Now, Alex, can you know, do the real wizard talk about that?
All right. So I feel it's like a really rough thing to go straight into Garrisons, right? You're working so many other major features like replays, which is a phenomenal case study of production saving a feature that was basically dead for a couple of years, yes. Right? But let's go ahead and go into the Garrisons real quick. So ultimately, Garrisons was about a fantasy misalignment between the action of running through a fantasy world, slaying monsters, and then sitting back and watching progress bars fill up as you stuck these little asynchronous, you know, it was basically adding Farmville type game mechanics into World of Warcraft. And while asynchronous progress is cool, the expression of it was very UI based, very much a Facebook game. And so it was just, you know, we didn't really match what the kind of expectation for what World of Warcraft would feel like, right? And so even though the entities, the little, so basically you went and collected all these minions around the world, which was cool, right? Going through a quest and collecting, having someone add to your town. That part was really cool. But then the reward mechanism connected to that was sending the right minion on the right mission, and then it would come back and bring you back some loot and sometimes upgrades and tokens and all of that. And even the rewards themselves were okay, but this process of just having to basically play color match, and there wasn't any problem solving, there wasn't any creativity to personal expression. And the end result was you just kind of like followed the instruction set, you did what you did, and then you came back the next day and you opened a chest, right? Mm. Just didn't feel like a Warcraft adventure.
Yeah.
Well, what about replay then? If that's sort of like on the opposite end of your achievements.
Yeah. So I'll say to talk about, you know, production and its partnership with game design. So where Garrisons was at when I arrived, and this is, to me, this is at the heart of what the stewardship that a game producer, an effective game producer does, is we have to make the work, the outcomes, and the level of effort highly visible to the team, all of the creative and engineering team members, so that we can say, all right, for the outcome that we're trying to achieve, this is the volume of what we're pursuing. Now we need to have real dialogue around where our current course of action is likely to take us. And so coming into Garrisons, the number of environments, and I'm going from memory, so people who I won't name, if you end up watching this, don't kill me for getting it wrong. It's been a while. The number of buildings, the number of build phases, the asset load that it was going to take to, you know, productionize and deliver that, it was like, we're never going to get there. We will never land this plane, folks. And so we had to basically bring folks together and as producers talk through, this is too big for when we know, because, you know, we had, you know, with pre-orders, there's a date that's, you know, you'll get this game, you'll get this expansion by this date. Now, we hope to God we never have to get close to that date. But it is a hard date, and if we run past it, bad things happen, right? Legal liability things happen. And so bringing people together, and at some point I think we'll get into what is effective production, how does it look like compared to maybe less effective production, and what are some of the anti-patterns that producers are so often guided into that I think, yeah, that I think put producers at odds with the creative, particularly the creative part. I mean, yeah, I think the yeah, engineering side of things, they tend to align and see it more clearly because in my opinion, engineering is in service of the creative. They're creating the capabilities to enable these creative expressions and experiences. And so there are production anti-patterns that are actually defaults that you would use. Like if you just went out there and started Googling, you'd get guided that way.
All right, real quick. So we're going to terminology here that's a little heavier. These people haven't been in production. Like, you talk about what is an anti-pattern and how do they appear in development?
Yes. So anti-patterns, and that expression largely emerged in the software engineering, software product development spaces outside of games. But just as a pattern would be something that you would want to follow, that is a set of steps that you can execute to achieve an outcome, an anti-pattern would be a set of steps that you want to avoid taking because it achieves a less desirable version or a lack of an outcome.
I'm reminded of a quote from Rick and Morty that says, sure, we'll do it the dumbest way possible because it's easier for you, right?
Yes.
All right. So let's go ahead and let's just kind of like do a really quick example here. Let's say that I'm the programmer slash, engineer, right, yeah, on a product. And Ari is the artist and designer, right? And you're the producer. Okay, so let's go through a little process. Ari, go ahead and come up with a game, and then we'll talk about the feature and how that breaks down. And then Barry would jump in the way he might and be like, oh, hey, we need to keep track of this. So go ahead and tell us what the game is.
Okay. The game is called Swamp Witch. A witch who lives in the woods and wants to be left alone. But people are trying to bring you back into society, so you have to repel them through various means, including potions and spells, and you can level up your abilities with probably components that you can farm and gather in the swamp where you live. Maybe you have some familiar sidekicks, like a frog or a black cat, that can help you with collecting those components. And primarily, it would be an FPS based on magic wand, and you would be able to switch out crystals in the magic wand for different abilities. That's the concept.
Okay. All right, cool. Oh my God, there's so many features there. Okay, let me think. Okay, so start with an FPS. Okay, we can take a template for an FPS. We've got some networking software we can reuse for multiplayer FPS combat. That's no problem. Okay, but wait, this game is about collecting stuff. Oh shoot, we don't have any FPSs with collecting systems. I've got to write a collecting system. We've got to make herbs. That means I need to track assets. Oh shit, is this a real-time game? Is this an offline game? Is this a single-player game? Is it a multiplayer game? I have to do different things based on all of these. Holy shit. Okay, wait a minute. Familiars, that's AI. Oh man, what about the AI for the entities in the game? What are the entities going to do? Oh God, I'm really panicked. There's a whole lot of stuff going on here. Barry,
gang, this sounds great. This sounds like a blast. Let's go through drawing some things. Let's whiteboard some things or Miro some things right now. But so what I would do is, so, and you probably saw me, I wasn't ignoring you. I immediately went to my producerly ways of my notebook is right here. So I'm listening and writing, right? And so just real quickly, I captured, okay, so, you know, Swamp Witch. Let me get it where I'm not messing up my microphone's audio. All right, so I heard you cover, you know, all right, people are trying to bring her back to civilization. She's resisting it. Okay, I'm immediately thinking, is this single player or multiplayer? And how many different types of people or how many people are going to be coming to bring her, you know, bring her back to civilization? They are going to. She is going to be able to use potions, spells. There is going to be leveling mechanic to it. We're talking about sidekicks, okay? I'm listening to all of the systems that I'm hearing, and then what I'll typically do then is to just begin to visually whiteboard or diagram, just draw shapes with those names in them, and say, and then I usually only have to get just an initial canvas of those, and then Alex started throwing out systems that we could possibly leverage, and the ones that we would have to create, and that's when his blood pressure went up when we got to the ones that he had to create. And I'm typically trying to create a picture of these are all the things. Mm-hmm. These are all the things that, and if I was in a physical room, I would do it with Post-its on a whiteboard or a wall, because what I want next is I get that initial set of things up there, and then I either have shapes they can copy and paste in the diagramming tool online, or stacks of Post-its. Everyone's given Post-its and Sharpies. And I say, now, let's start moving. Like, what are the things that we think this is not even worth doing if we didn't have? And things that we think are probably like, maybe those are cool, put those out like on the periphery. So like there's an inner circle and an outer circle, and just start a, and this is to be at the heart of production, creating a framework like that and then stepping back. Yep. And letting the creatives begin to dialogue.
Yep. So now let's imagine that we've got these two rings, the vital features and the extra feature. So Ari, as the designer, right, you're stepping into this. What features are absolutely essential to the experience you want here?
I would say absolutely essential. You have to be able to fire spells from the wand. And you have to be able to collect items from the area that you live. But non-essentially, I don't think that we absolutely have to have the familiars. And I don't think that we have to have potions.
Cool. All right, great. So now we know that crafting system and companions are on that periphery, right? They're things that would be nice to have. Maybe we can add those in expansion, maybe, but they're not what we need to do right now. So cool. Now he's a programmer, like, okay, cool. What about a very important question, though? Multiplayer or single player?
Single player. You play as the witch. All people from society, from normal society, are going to be enemies that you fight.
Got it. Okay. So, all right, great. That means I don't have to worry about networking. Whew, just saved $3 million there. I don't have to worry about anything too crazy or synchronized over the network. So even physics is just going to be local. There's another $500,000 saved. Fantastic. All right, cool. So we need wand gunplay, right? So we got to figure that out. We need some entities that look like normal people. They're showing up with suits and ties and briefcases or whatever you want.
Pilates instructor, yeah.
And they're going to come up and try to get you to sign contracts, right? To sign your life away, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever. All right, cool. Great. I can do that. That's more achievable. Wand gunplay. We don't have something to work off of that before. So I think that might take 8 months, right? Just to get the tech in there. I think the AI, right, well, we can probably do something really quick in a couple of weeks, but for what we really want, we want those people to be smart or to say witty things, we might be looking at another 6 to 8 months of that there too. Okay, so we're looking at, what was the other two features? There's a couple more features in there. Oh, collection.
Yes.
Yeah. We can do a basic inventory system, a quick and dirty one in a week, and then the complicated one with the UI and the interface, that'll be another 4 months.
There we go. So we've got, now what I would do next is say, all right, how about this? Instead of months, maybe we, and I will often try to do this at the start, is to say, let's start with t-shirt sizes.
Oh.
Where we do small, medium, large, extra large. And then there's always the wisecrack who, what about 2 and 3 XL and the petite, you know, extra small? Like, no, just small, medium, large, extra large. And I have folks, and I'll, in an exercise like this, I would probably have on the Post-it or the shape, I would have design, art, engineering size. Mm-hmm. And have them put, you know, from small to extra large. And there's a couple of things that I'm trying to do there. When there's a thing that happens psychologically as people, when we start talking about the size of something in a time interval, days or months, because there are some people in the room who begin to immediately do calendar math. And then they start talking about timeline early. They say, well, he said 8 months, so then we can launch it in August, right? You're like, no, that's not what we're saying. That's not what we're saying. Size does not equal duration. Because I'm wanting to the space I'm wanting to create for this creative and collaborative cross-functional, by cross-functional terminology, meaning they're not everyone of the same career or craft. You know, this is not a homogenous group. So one of the things I love about doing product development and production with video games is it takes so many distinct crafts to do anything in a game that you have to get people from different avenues and perspectives talking and interacting together. And that's when the magic unlocks. And so to foster that and to avoid, you know, to try and keep fear or timeline pressures or premature decisions from creeping in, I'll use t-shirt sizes and just let's just keep it talking. Let's keep it talking about roughly rough size. And when we've had a really good conversation about the fun, and that might be a few sessions, honestly, then let's talk about, all right, now that we're, you know, now that we've teased out what we think this experience is going to be and why is this a game we should absolutely go make, well, now we can start to talk about size, because that's when we're going to start talking about people, resources, you know, and then eventually timelines. Because, you know, I mean, and maybe the two of you can probably speak to personal experiences where you're in a conversation about a cool opportunity or a cool game, and time or budget enters the conversation really early, and how that feels. Like, feel free to share if you've experienced that.
Yeah, it becomes very restrictive very early, right? As opposed to saying, because here's the thing that a good producer will do, right? A bad producer will just be like, all right, let's just line this stuff up and go. Right? A good producer will sit down and, okay, say, what is essential? What is the order we need to figure out these things? And they'll above all ask, what are the goals and what you're going for, right? They're always going to make sure you guys are focused on what you're trying to achieve. For example, the goal of wand gunplay, is it just thematic gunplay, or is it to create a sense of power over the world? Is it a way of interacting with those people coming into the game world, right? Like, they're normies and you're gonna turn them into frogs. Okay, so it's really more about keeping them off your back, right? Okay, fine. But if it's actually about deeply strategic, you know, gameplay, well, then you need to have additional layers. It's more important to the core experience, whereas maybe it's mostly a narrative game and the one gunplay is actually surface level. And a good producer will help guide you through those right steps and make sure you're making the right things for your goals, and then figure out. So, and then let's continue our example, just a couple more minutes. So, all right, let's do the t-shirt sizes. So which of these features are the largest? Very important to the game.
Let's see, the most important features. I would say the biggest t-shirt size, the extra large, is the ability to cast a variety of spells from the wand that have interesting effects. I think that's the most critical thing. And then probably medium t-shirt, collecting things from the woods.
Okay, makes sense. That's your core loop. Go into the world, interact with spells, get items, bring it back.
Small t-shirt, familiars. Yep. And I didn't mention this before, but it would also be a small t-shirt to be able to have character customization, because I think everybody likes that. But also that's hard and a lot of work. So,
all right. So I would actually, this is where you can now have a discussion. Well, actually, character customization, that's a size small tech, but that could be a size large art task, right? So all of the different disciplines have different amounts of work they need to bring to the table for these two.
I see.
Absolutely. And it's for me, in production, when you can facilitate discussions like this where the different disciplines start to understand more about one another, you build empathy and awareness, and people actually respect, you know, what might be small for the two others is large for the others. I remember, in fact, I'm thinking about, there's one real example of mine on a game team I was stewarding at Riot, and there were 9 different functional skills, people with, you know, discrete career paths in the team, and the art was the most constrained thing we had, and we were breaking down outcomes for a feature we were working on, and our artist was also one of the less vocal people. We had plenty of vocal engineers in the group, and as we were estimating the relative size of things, the sizes that kept being assigned to things and the way work was being broken down very much favored the more engineering-centric view. And I had encouraged our artists after several sessions over a few weeks, you know, I really want you to advocate for yourself, because I'm not going to push you, but I think that we really need to hear from you in these discussions. And there were one of those sessions, and they were breaking things down, and she finally just in a very quiet and composed way, and actually, Alex, you know this person, in a very quiet and composed way, she said, "Well, this is a lot of artwork, and there are one of me and seven of you, so it would probably be a good idea for you to listen to me tell you how to break this down so that we optimize for throughput through me, since there's one of me and seven of you." And it was, it wasn't confrontational per se. It was just the trust and the comfort with speaking up was there, and the healthy interaction happened. And that was the start of what I recall as a turn in that team's holistic perspective. And that's what you're going with production. When you get people interacting and feeling comfortable being real with one another, just magic unlocks. I love that about production.
One of the things that I've always really valued about you personally, Barry, is that your great emphasis on healthy team structure and dynamics, right? Because there isn't a one-size-fits-all solution for things, but there is a certain standard of conduct and dynamic for how people treat and observe each other. I always like to share this one story about, I had a very young art director I was working with, and, you know, this was her first full directorship project that wasn't school-based. And when we started, it was always, you know, Alex, what do I do? Alex, what do I do? Alex, what do I do? And, you know, and I eventually remember that I was like, well, you know, you've had really good insight and really good opinions. What do you think we should do? And, you know, she's like, well, maybe this or that. But we kept checking in. I remember one day when she came in, and it finally just, I was just like, listen, you're making good decisions. You're giving us good direction. Tell us what to do. And one day she came in, she's like, okay, Alex, here is what we need to do. Will you back me up? So I'm like, yes. And it changed everything after that. People listened to her. Then it was just a matter of supporting her through the vision rather than people keep looking to me to check in. And that's everything, right? Because that's a moment where someone is in their own power, is in their talent, and is growing and becoming amazing. And now this person runs their own game studio. So, right?
That's awesome. I live for those moments. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it's so rewarding.
I feel like it must be such a joy to work on one of your teams, Barry, just from this exercise. I can tell that your communication style is so healthy.
We all have our days, this is my default. In fact, real story about when I, because sometimes you have to flex from your default style, and I'm always real clear on what things I can and can't say for my non-game work, you know, because those have very clear boundaries. But with games, so I said, okay, can I talk about this? But we were so if I use the concept gold master, is that a fairly ubiquitous term for the audience? Basically getting to the final release candidate where you're basically submitting this to QA and localization and everything and saying, we really think this is it.
Like, okay. It's an old term from the days where you would physically print the game onto a gold CD that was of high quality and then physically take it to the manufacturing plant.
I see. Okay.
So that's what the term means. And we were World of Warcraft being a very dramatic example, but game development at scale, it's where you start to see some of the human factors really intensify. It's one of the things I love about working on larger projects. But performance for Warlords of Draenor going into Gold Master was abysmal. I'm talking about, you're on the one character in a local copy of the world. just walking through the environment, and you can't get above 12 frames a second. Yeah.
We had the same issues on Ori. At one point, we had this area called, I want to say Luma Pools, I think. And you would enter it, and it was utterly beautiful, but you went 5 frames a second through it. And, you know, it was like that for almost 6 months before launch, you know?
And people don't, yeah, it's, you know, and until you've been in it, you don't realize just how far into the creation process you can be and still be so far away from shippable. And that example stands out to me because I was, at that point, I was producing for a group of people, some of whom had been working together for much of the life of that game. So it's not like we had a bunch of, well, there was definitely a core of people who had been working together for a long time. But even for those people who had been working together for a long time, when I saw this and I went to my boss, I was going to say his name and I thought, well, maybe I don't, anyway. I said, I'm going to have a meeting around the performance passes because this, I need to bring everybody together. And he had this look on his face, like, wonder how that'll go. I brought environment art, design and engineering together. And, there was a person, a game engineer who, has done much of the work on that engine for many, many years. And I had gotten
Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scott Harton.
Yes. Yep. Scott Harton.
He was there from Brown Box.
Love days. That
That's
guy.
Almost,
yeah.
Almost 10 years on just on performance and rendering.
They're like, hey, you know, performance is completely non-viable right now. And we need to get everybody to call from the environment. There was just too much stuff. There was too much stuff in the environment. But they're like, now, however, when I said I'm going to bring everybody together, they said, are you bringing engineering? And I said, well, yeah, we have to have it. And they're like, I don't think that's going to work. And I met with Scott and Frank Kolakowski at the time to talk about, I wanted to hear their pain. I'm like, so I'm putting this meeting together. And this is going to be the purpose. Just me and Frank and Scott in a room. And they're like, well, it just, you know, the past scars just immediately just, oh, what happens every time is we all get, you know, the game launches and everybody's high-fiving and it's a champagne celebration, but we can't go outside because the performance, especially of the raids, is absolute crap and it's crashing and we're having to work, you know, 24 hours a day to rectify this. And what I said, well, my goal is for us to be able to talk together. The reason we're coming together is because if we can look at this beforehand, hopefully we can make proactive choices and trade-offs.
Why were they so skeptical of that?
Past experience in history, to which Alex can speak more authoritatively.
Sure.
Having been there.
I'll go into that a little bit. So the issue is that as you work with various teams over time, certain habits ingrain themselves into cultures.
Yes.
One of them being, for example, that artists push forward and they don't necessarily reach out to check in at how fast they're going or even examine the detail level of the assets they're producing. I remember there's one famous story of there was a rock that was like a very decent looking rock. It wasn't anything particularly special, but it had something like 20,000 polys in this rock. And mm-hmm. that just happened because someone hit generate a rock and then tossed it in the game. But this, the way that the Warcraft worked would be you would take an asset, it would then assess all the surfaces and then create a pathing map. So there would be 20,000 different connections around the edge of this rock on the terrain, yep. which then created effectively a black hole of AI pathing data where it had to search too many ways to navigate a rock.
Yep.
This rock could have been 100 polys easily, right? Yep. But no one looked at it. And instead, people just walked in like, hey, as soon as I load the barons, performance goes to nothing. And people are like, oh, that's really weird. It was because 20 of these rocks were dropped in randomly around yep. the place.
Yes.
And it goes to someone like Scott, who is, you know, a very systems level. Yes. And he's just like, what the fuck? What? Oh my goodness. Orgrimmar must be broken. There's 20,000 pathways here. And he's looking at Orgrimmar really intensely. Yeah. And then it turns out to be a rock.
Yeah.
And and this sense of frustration and all of this, looking at what he thinks is a big problem turns out to be a small, effectively stupid problem, right? Yeah. Because someone was careless when they created an art asset. Creates, and this repeats over and over with every generation of artists, because every person coming in learns a new set of lessons. Mm-hmm. And it creates a history of like, well, I'm here to clean up other people's messes.
In that one, some of the ones that I saw when I was there were, there was a pet, a non-combat pet or a battle pet, as we say now. Alex. It was based on a raid boss. Well, the other thing about long-lived games is the tools and pipelines. There's a lot of arcane tribal knowledge around what to do and what not to do with this very sharp and rusty pair of scissors that you're just being told to run with. And so someone took a raid boss. Like, would it not be the coolest thing if you had your own little one of these running around? And so what happened was and the way that engine works is you can just shrink things. Now, it still had all of the polys and animations that the raid boss had. And now everyone can take one alongside. And that was a nightmare. And then another one was there was someone doing some landscape work, and there was this altar mm-hmm. on this landscape. And they're like, "This, look at that." And it wouldn't run. Or it was running in like a really weirdly awful, horrible way. And then it turns out, oh, these little altars that they've put throughout the landscape, that's actually the top of a building. And they just took the whole building, pushed it underground, and like, there's the little steeple. Isn't that a cool altar?
I feel so like that's really basic, though. That's so basic.
It is basic, but this is at the heart, and this is at the heart of what I believe production is supposed to do. We are supposed to bring everyone together, because if we don't come together, if art and design and engineering don't come together, we will astound ourselves at the assumptions that will slip past us. Because and this is why it's so important in my view of game development for the skills to work together. Because when you have to, as a given skill, when you have to work in a silo, there you have to make certain assumptions around what the other people have to do to do their part. And we're a few decades into proving as humans making video games that when that happens, we can impress ourselves with how far off we can get.
Yeah. For example, I'll talk a little bit about that little fell. Was it the Fell Reaver? Was it Ragnaros?
I think it was the Fell Reaver. Yeah.
So I made the Fell Reaver, and that's why I loved it. Barry pulled that one out. The Fell Reaver was originally created to be a colossal monster that was only supposed to ever be one of inside Outlands, walking around in a giant patrol loop, such that when it stormed through an area, a large, like, bong sound would play to everyone in the zone to warn you it was coming, right? Like a train engine. Well, when they shrank it down, right, all of the impact sounds for the boom, 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 right, of each footstep still was there attached to the Fell Reaver. So they shrank it down, but developers, because you're in a social environment, you might have 6-7 developers in a room, right? You turn off your audio because you don't want everyone else to hear the noise. So this tiny little Fell Reaver had all of the stompity, stompity, stompity sounds of the big Fell Reaver, but you'd summon it up and it ran in town, and no one caught this until I think it was actually on the PTRs. Right. And it was like, oh, hey, yeah, we're running around Orgrimmar and there's just sonic chaos as there's 8 of these little guys running around and you could not hear anything due to all the bongs playing.
And when you shrink something down, it's not like the audio is going to automatically shrink with it. So that must have been horrible.
No. Yep. And and the animations for the little feats, which was like visually go chunk, chunk. So again, these loud footsteps were okay because they were rare, every few seconds apart. Now they were going, and so you just go.
Yep.
Sounds like people should wear headphones.
Well, then this comes to the social aspect. Then people say, why are you listening to headphones and blocking all the people out who need to talk to you? And you tap people on the shoulder, And he's like, it's like talking to someone at the gym with headphones on. Should you bother them? Should you not bother them?
Yeah.
When is it okay? Right.
I see.
So, yeah, that's a great example. Okay. So let's move this forward a little bit. So those were some really great concrete examples of very small things, right? How did the final solution work with the pathing and performance stuff? How did that get brought to a conclusion? And then let's talk a little bit about some other bigger scope projects. And I'd love to hit replays. And I want to talk more about how you form teams.
Absolutely. So that performance thing. So there was the eventual meeting, but I prepped with the same way that I prepped with engineering. I also prepped with art and design. So I pre-met with them and said, now we're going to come together and I understand there's history, but I need everyone to make a good faith effort to just assume positive intent because we've got to get this handled. And we came together and I actually had engineering, we had the game up. And there's a special, you know, UI that shows all the perf data. And so like that one Draenei lady is walking through and it's like, see, it's not working. This isn't going to go. And it's like, all right, so what do we need to do? And then everyone talking about, you know, how you have to flex as a producer and with your style. Everyone started venting a bit and at an impasse, like, well, I'm not going to do, well, this would be horrible if I change anything. So I'm not going to change anything, you know, from art and design and engineering is like, well, they won't effing run. And so I said, well, ladies and gentlemen, performance is in the shitter. And so this is never going to ship if we don't make some decisions. And what I'm being told is if we can't proactively make those decisions, apparently some other people are just going to go in and start culling stuff out using their judgment. So can we, I would just love it if we could all work together and figure out a path forward. I said, no, you know, and I think it was Scott. You know, Scott, can you explain why this is true? Why this is problematic? Like help us understand what makes it run. And so he actually started talking through some of the concepts. And at that point, we were actually not in Shattrath. At that point, we were out in Ashran, the battleground. Which, boy, talking about a performance nightmare. And then I remember there was this one point where he's like, and because all of this stuff is line of sight, it all has to be rendered. And he turned the character, and you saw the numbers just go, whoa. And two designers said, wait, you're saying if we can see it, and it has, then it's going to do that? And he's like, yeah. And one guy, he's, shit. they didn't know that they, you know, they, and this is what I mean by, you know, you can't, the expense or the peril of working in silos without bringing people together. That if you, and I do believe, I mean, I know, you know, there are people who are a handful, but generally, people are not showing up for work every day trying to make a mess of things and be horrible to other people. You know, it's that whole, you know, you hear people talk about assuming positive intent. Mm-hmm. But it's just at scale and with these barriers, misunderstandings can crop up and take root. And so for me and what I coach and mentor producers on is you need to be looking for those. You're in that way, you're like a gardener of team health and you're looking for these weeds and problems, and you want to bring people together. And don't you be the go-between, because then you just become this really crappy game of telephone. You need to bring people together and get out of the way. And at some point, if we talk about, you know, producer, undesirable producer behavior, I get into that. So that's how it worked out. And we actually did, I should say, that group actually did make trade-offs. And there was the removal of some stuff that, I will say, also led to, in the particular case of Ashran, also it being a better battleground, because some of the collision that was actually making for really frustrating world PvP also came out as a part of the performance work, because we were doing it collaboratively, right? When you know that some things have to go, you're like, well, this is stuff people have to jump over or go around anyway. So yeah, that's how it resolved.
That sounds great.
And I really love how you said it, right? Your job is not to be the messenger just of status, but to bring people together. Bring people together at the right time.
Yes.
Right? Let's talk about some of those particular faux pas, right?
Yeah.
One of them is too many meetings, right? Which comes from insecurity about your ability to communicate and or lack of awareness, right? When to bring people together. The other one is never having meetings and just trying to keep everything at a radar or at arm's length. And I think the last one that I can think of is complete siloing and believing that if you are on top of all the silos, it's going to work out.
Yes.
It doesn't work.
Those are common patterns. So I'll say this. The video game industry has actually benefited from the boom in multiplayer online games because there's been an influx of people from other environments, product development environments and settings who've been brought into the equation, who not all of them, but some of them are used to this greater degree of collaboration and understanding that, hey, there's more than one way to approach product development and managing a project, you know, if you will, which has been, in my view, fantastic for particularly the last 15 years, I'll say, of video game development. Because when you, like so many parts of game development, it is very much an apprentice journeyman type of field, right? Where you come in, lots of people come in through QA or CS, and then they get their first design they get their first design or sometimes art role. That's typically hard, but there's a saying, and I don't know if you all have heard this before, but a little shorthand of when people are trying to break into game teams, you'll hear people say, can you draw? Nope, you're not going to be doing art. Can you code? Not going to be doing engineering. How are you at design? So-so? Well, then you can produce. And so a lot of times people who are just want to get into a game team, it's like, well, production seems to be the only thing that's just like, whatever. You know, it doesn't require a particular hard skill. But what I've seen now, mentoring and coaching now hundreds of people in game production, you know, for the last a little over 10 years, after, you know, 20 plus years of doing it in all other contexts, when people enter into production and it's like, well, this game is basically a project, how do I do this production work? And either what the person who's already there tells them or when they just go online, is they're usually guided to some flavor of classical project management, which could not be a poorer fit for the creative collaborative effort that is game development if you tried to find a poorer fit. Because classical project management at its root is not collaborative. It's not iterative. It's decide everything, including how long it's going to take up front, and then either stick to that or make the paperwork look like you stuck to that. And that is in any creative endeavor, but I'll definitely say in video game development, that is a recipe for disaster and collateral damage and a lot of burnt out people. And that's what I see, you know, in terms of, if you look at all the producer anti-patterns that I see, when you trace them back, it's that most folks come up in the field thinking that there is no playbook, just YOLO, whatever. Or they think, well, it's that project management stuff like my dad did at the insurance company.
Yep. That's just for those who like terminology, I believe that's usually called waterfall, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Waterfall is very much not a good thing for an iterative process like game design or game development.
In fact, if you like lore, the lore of waterfall, waterfall was named waterfall in 1970. Because a gentleman who was speaking at a conference on software development of large systems, his second diagram in the white paper, because you didn't really do slides in 1970, you definitely didn't do PowerPoint, but his paper in the second diagram, it is what came to be called. The word waterfall is nowhere in the paper. It got the name waterfall because the second diagram shows from like design to, you know, specification to then coding, testing, and get it out there. He drew it in a vertical from top, upper right, from left top to bottom right. And the boxes went down, and they all had unidirectional arrows. And so people came to call it water because they're like, look, it's waterfall. It's like water or shit. Everything's just rolling downhill. And the more you are at the top, the less you deal with the shit in the water that gets to the bottom of the hill. But here's the fascinating thing. That second diagram was the beginning of the problem elaboration statement. It's in the first half of the paper where he's explaining the problem with what was becoming classical project management. This does not work well. In fact, the very next diagram he goes on to show, a lot of people are describing it that way. That's not really how it works. It really works this way. And he starts, you know, going through the problem. But then if you look at the last half of the paper, mm-hmm. he's like, now that all sucks. So I recommend these 10 things. The 10 things he recommends are all in line with, you know, we talk about, you know, agile or healthy game production. It all aligns with that. But
so the thing that got popular from his presentation was the thing that he said don't do.
Was that, yeah, so moral of the story, yep. Never take too long to describe the problem. People might think you're talking about the solution.
It's true.
I feel bad
it's
for
extremely
him.
True.
That was like my life's work and that's the one thing that people took away from it, I'd be so disappointed.
Oh, yeah. He has some awesome quotes in that paper.
Especially when he was so close to basically describing what was the correct method, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
Right there.
And so I find, you know, and so you take that belief that you can decide everything up front, decide the timeline, and then hand that to somebody else and say, now make that true. If you think about the fact that the type of training and information that so many people in production find online or are guided toward has that as an underlying philosophical principle, you can see why there's so much game production that is problematic, and you see it, and it manifests in ways like Alex was talking about with people who make all these silos, but they're sitting on top and it's all going to work because they're enough of a puppeteer, you know, to do this, or they love being at the center of things. So we're going to have a billion meetings about meetings. And you know, they're the information and interaction conduit. It neither scales nor works that well.
I have a quote that I like to throw in, which is ego is the death of effectiveness.
Yeah.
Right? And when you feel that you need to be the most important piece on the chessboard, you inevitably miss the ability. The weakest piece on a chessboard, by the way, is the most important one, which is the king, right? They don't have power. They delegate it to others. And that's so incredibly important for people to internalize, right? If you want to be more effective, you have to empower the others around you, yes. Not just imagine a chessboard full of pawns.
I love that.
Anyways, getting a little philosophical there, but obviously you've run into lots of, you know, teams where people have worked together effectively and where people have gone into friction.
Yeah.
Ari, what kind of teams have you been on at this point? Like, what experience do you have?
Yeah, I'd love
problems
to hear
about did
that.
You run into?
You've actually asked me this question before, Alex, but unfortunately I haven't worked on very many teams with people. Pretty much most of the work that I've done has been independent. I haven't worked for any companies yet. And in college, at least in the program that I did, it was very much structured for independent work. I would love to work on some teams, but mostly I just respond to feedback from my clients, which has some similarities, but it's also a lot more straightforward because it's really just back and forth between me and them.
I think I recall you saying in a prior episode that there were supposed to be group projects, but there were not group projects in your program.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, there was a class for group projects, but you had to specifically register for that, and it wasn't required for graduating. And
yeah,
other things were.
Yeah,
so
that was it.
Yep. Anyways, I kind of threw that in there though, right? Because you know what is the most important thing for getting into Veinville is working with other people, right?
Yeah.
Running through friction, learning through how to manage those problems, and moving forward, right? And it's so incredibly important to find teams of people. And also, I know you're trying right now to work with some people on a little project. And so that's important, right? And that's one of the things I want to encourage to anyone who's getting into this, whether you're a producer, an artist, a programmer, it doesn't matter. Work with other people, right? Learn their strengths and their skills, and you'll also appreciate more about what they do.
Yes.
And I think I found that to be such an important element of being part of a game development team.
Mm-hmm.
My own little toxic, you know, starting story was that I believe that producers were the destroyers of fun when I started at Blizzard, right?
Understandable.
And there's a guy named Lee Sparks. Was Lee still there when you joined?
Yeah.
Lee Sparks had just started as a super junior producer the same day I started as a super junior designer. And I was like, yeah, man, producer always pushing around, making you get stuff done before it's ready. And then it ends up being buggy and broken. I don't like it. And he's like, well, my goal is by the time, you know, you and I are higher up there, that you wish that I'm around as opposed to wishing I don't walk into your office. I'm like, yeah, well, we'll see about that, Lee. At first, he brought cookies, which kind of made things smoother to start. But by the end, right, at 5-6 years later, when I did see him, I'm like, oh, good, let's talk through some stuff. Let's figure out how to make this work. Or my favorite thing is the horse trading conversation. Hey, this is really important. And then the question is, like, okay, what can we give up to get more time to put the polish we need in that, right? Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of conversations that producers help you facilitate, right? They know who to go to. They know when to bring it up and how to read the room, right? More so than any, like, designers need to communicate clearly. Producers need to listen clearly and observe with a great sense of awareness of the emotional states of the people around them.
Mm-hmm. Barry, the last thing I really wanted to ask you about was replay. You guys have brought that up a couple of times. But I don't know what it is. So if you could just touch on that, I would love to hear about it.
Sure. So in most games and the game I was working on certainly wasn't the first, it was not at all the first one to do that. But it's the idea, and particularly with match-based multiplayer games, replays can be super helpful in being able to go back and look at how your match went. And how you did, and how, if you play on a more fixed and regular team, how are you doing with one another? You know, or if it was just a kind of like glory days, you know, if it's that one match you want to go back and be able to watch over and over again, where you got that pentakill or whatever, you know, it's handy for that. And so I joined Riot, and was immediately given, two areas to start with, and one of them was player behavior, but the other one was the replays project. Now, I had not been told much lore. I just knew that there was no momentum. Like this, they're like, yeah, we're going to start you with these. I'm like, love it. Throw me at the ones that are problematic. I'd rather start with problematic, because then there's a clear and present need for improvement. And it was a team where what we were being asked to do was generally understood, but not specifically experientially understood. Also, the technological approach we were going to take was not worked out at all. And so with that group, I had two artists, some really frustrated, two artists who were like, well, at some point, four or five really frustrated engineers, because this had been just spinning and spinning and spinning. And so I had, you know, the first few weeks were really just getting them out of the doldrums and saying like, all right, well, this seems intractable, but let's assess where we are and let's see, what are some incremental steps forward? What are some things we know? Like, if we don't know a solution, what are some next 2-week-ish size things that we could try, just things we could try? We know they're not a guarantee, but let's just try them. And just building that confidence with that team and saying, look, you're trying, you know, you're incrementally trying and doing things, and we're making, look, we've worked through some of the technical problems. And a funny thing about, I can't believe I didn't realize this, but this team was where Alex and I met. Because we were starting, I can't remember if it was a cycle planning or if it was a, like, you know, backlog grooming and refinement meeting, but Alex joined, and I still remember you came in and you popped up on, there was some furniture, like there was the team sitting at the table, and you came in, you popped up on this piece of furniture on the side of the wall, and you listened to everybody for a while, and then you stopped everybody and said, hey, can I tell you guys something? Do you know how exciting what you're working on is? Like, this ability is going to be so fun. People are waiting for this to happen. This is fantastic. But you guys, you don't seem very excited about it. And I'm not sure why. And it was, now, with everything that I'd been taking them through, I could not have said, like, if I had said, hey, Effers, aren't y'all excited? I know this has been hell, but why aren't you, where's your smiles? But, you know, Alex, as the, you know, the new and inquisitive team member, he came in and asked that. And it was really interesting because they couldn't shoot it down right away. They're like, well, you know, and they just, well, it hasn't been easy getting to this point. And, you know, and there was just, you know, there was some, there was some good conversation and dialogue, and having Alex there as a designer focused on this, who could talk about the experience, why this mattered, why this would have a visceral impact on players. That was, we had worked through some of the technical crap, the hard crap, around just technologically, how will we do this, that we had a path forward, and now it's, and here's why, here's the inspiration. And the momentum built, and hilariously, we built so much momentum that it was time to start ordering. It was time to start doing the budgeting and the ordering for what we were going to have to do in the data centers. And so myself and the product steward. So, all right. So producer means different things at different places. And the production that we're talking about is managing the work and the work systems. Some studios talk about producer as almost a designer that doesn't design, sort of, if you will. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about one that manages work. So the person who was the designer but not designer had gone with me to meet with the IT group, and we're talking about, like, here's what we're going to need. And so suddenly people see how many millions of dollars actually it's going to be to provision the hardware. And suddenly it's a problem. And then we found out that actually the founders philosophically disagreed on the validity, or even whether or not having replays was heresy. But they had, it was so stuck prior to my arrival and then Alex joining. It was so stuck, they assumed we're never going to have to worry about it because it's never going to get done.
They believed it was actually impossible. So they're like, sure, put some people on it. Let's see if it's feasible. And then Barry, right, getting the engineers moving, and got, like, moving little roadblocks out of the way. I can't take credit for anything other than showing up and being really excited because I wanted this feature yesterday. Right. All of a sudden, they had all of these barriers out of the way. Yeah. And literally, it was signing a check and mm-hmm. building the service, which, yeah, by the way, is still going to be a 6-9 month a year process. Yeah. Right. So you're saying, so this momentum built up so much.
Yeah, it did. Where suddenly they thought something that would never happen. Suddenly it's like, it's time to write checks. Mm-hmm. And so then there were all the philosophical arguments until things eventually happened. But that is, to me, it's a very memorable experience of taking a team that actually pretty much everybody assumed, well, it's never going to happen. And people were burning out and languishing on this team, and they were really bright, talented people. Just their weeks were sucking, mm-hmm. you know, being put on this project. And so, even for something that ended up being as, you know, controversial as it was, once it was actually ready to be, like, are we doing this or not? Mm-hmm. It's just
someone getting their shoes warmed up and pulling the trigger, and then it was
away it went. And it was just It is just, it's a very rewarding thing, but it all began with, can we help people have safe conversations?
Yes.
Around what we're trying to do and the constraints and the challenges and the unknown. And in my experience, if you can bring people together, get them talking and feeling safe with one another, look out, because I have pretty much always had good things come out of that. Even if it's a project that didn't see the light of day, what we learned and what we took from that was still a good thing.
Yeah. In fact, one of those times I remember having a safe conversation was on one of the R&D projects at Riot. I can't go into the details, obviously, because I remember there was a go around, and eventually I remember Cadwell came in. He was, you know, and like he'd built a good amount of trust between the engineers and the designers on the team, and said, "All right, everyone, just get around the table right now. Just bear with me. Everyone, heads down. Close your eyes. I'm the only person looking in the room. Just thumbs up if you think this project's going really well. Here if you think it's iffy, and here if you're just not like in the direction in which we'd reboot. Let me just take a poll." Then looking around the room, he's like, "All right, like, cool. I'm not going to tell you guys exactly how many, but just about all of you had thumbs down. Almost all of you want off this project or to start it over again. So why are we doing this? Let's go back and revisit that and see if there's a different way of approaching it or find something new to do." And it actually ended up being the turning point in reapproaching everything in a way that people were more excited about. Gameplay, throwing out this really old Chinese engine that we had that was super problematic. And that's why safe conversations are so incredibly important. Now, Barry, these calls usually only go about an hour, but there's something I'd really love to have you dig into just a little bit, sure, if you and Ari are cool with that.
Yeah, sure.
All right. I want you to talk about building those kind of safe teams, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the term safe has been really misused in the last few years, right? People think safe means not challenging. It means not having difficult conversations, not about persevering through struggle. And in truth, safe teams are about the opposite of that.
Yes.
Would you mind just talking about what a safe team is and how you build them? Because it's something you do.
Absolutely, yeah. And I would say what I talk about most often, the terms I use most often are you know, a healthy and effective team, because you're right. Like, what's... Yes. Healthy and effective, while you have to clarify what that means, I do feel like safe, you have to even spend even more time trying to clarify, because people think it means that, oh, we are just this amorphous blob that never gets anything done. But it's, so I think it's, for me, it starts with the charter. That is, what are we asking this team to come together for and be excited about? Right? What is it? Because so often teams get thrown together because someone with not as much skin in the game, but a lot more authority or influence, decides that a team should exist, even if that charter is not fleshed out, you know? So I think starting with, why are we asking people to come to work, show up, and pour their all into this endeavor together? So that's one critical thing. Another thing is who we put together and when. Alex said something earlier about bringing the right people together at the right time. It is important to bring different skills together, but the right skills together at the right time. And there is no cookie cutter formula for this, but I'll just to speak generally. In the early stages, I believe you do want engineering, design, and art together. Possibly UX. We won't go into that, but just depending on what, you know, game design does and what product design or UX does. But you at least need those disciplines together, because they need to be seeing what it takes for each of their parts to possibly produce this thing, you know, to develop this thing that we're asking them to create. And that needs to be small enough for there to be a lot of iteration. So it doesn't necessarily mean one of each, you know, but a balance and appropriate number of each for them to be able to collaborate and bounce off one another. So I'll say this, and some people say, okay, so one designer, one producer, one, and like, no, that's not, no. Cause then it's like, okay, you've got one person who manages work, one creative, and one, you know, and one person who creates the platform to enable it. That's not a good mix, you know? So it's like maybe a producer over, you know, a few incubator type efforts. So they're facilitating the creative process, documenting and journaling and chronicling things, but you need enough designers to bounce off of and have those creative conversations, and then enough engineering representation to understand, okay, what's being talked about? What systems are we possibly, you know, speaking to, and then to say, well, that would imply this, that would imply the other thing. And then once that gets going, then it's like, okay, This is something to pursue. Now it's time to staff this up. Here's where I see game teams go wrong often, is they too much of the wrong type of skill too soon on a team. So you load them up, like you give them a ton of artists, but actually what to do with the art is not clear yet. Or you give them a ton of engineers, but what to engineer is not clear yet. Now you've got, so for every conversation this team is having, the conversation is heavier and harder than it needs to be. And 60 to 70% of the room are sitting on their hands while they're on their phones. Because this, it's like... And
I wanted to jump in. This was the death of Titan. There were too many artists, each one exploring a different region of the planet at the time, and all struggling to fight over what the final graphical style vision would be. Mm. They needed three really good people doing one or two areas, really tightening in on the style, and then bringing in a couple auxiliary people over time to make more assets.
Yeah, it's a success can be a paralyzing thing, because you'll hear some people say, well, if I just, you know, I have this awesome game idea, and if I just had the people, then it would happen. Don't count on it, because you know, some of us have been in positions where it's like, how we have legion. We have legion people that we can throw at something, but doing it with the right beginning, with the right number of people, cultivating that, nurturing it, and then scaling it appropriately at the right time is way harder than it looks or it sounds in a GDC talk.
And I'd like to throw some more stuff in there too, right? It's not only making sure you have the right people and work for them to do, it's also about building a structure for them to communicate with each other. It's about letting people get stupid ideas out and that being okay.
Yes.
It's about letting people being themselves while not allowing them to infringe on others in an effective way.
Oh.
Right. And so much of that is kind of still a learning lesson in this industry, a lot of creative industries.
So when I do talk about safe, I'm usually specifically talking about psychological safety. So I've begun to focus a lot the last couple of years on using the term psychological safety, meaning every member of this team needs to feel that expressing themselves and engaging in this team would not result in feeling psychologically unsafe or attacked or undermined or belittled or made to feel less. And so I spend a lot of time both in working with producers, but then also in embedding at times and sitting in the passenger seat, having to do language correction. Because then, you know, someone will say, well, like, all right, well, this is a stupid idea. And I'll say, actually, it's, you know, it's probably just an unorthodox one or one we haven't thought of yet. So don't feel that you have to say it's stupid. Let's just, but we're here to tease out. If there was a, you know, if we knew which ideas were stupid and not, we would already be well on our way. So we need to be able to entertain myriad things and let them breathe long enough. Because if we're concerned that, well, is this a stupid idea? A number of great ideas get killed prematurely. Before the, you know, because like, you know, when something's an embryo, it's really hard to, like, so is that going to be good? I don't know. It looks like a biology quiz. But if you give it a little time, it's like, ooh, that, look at that. That actually could be good. Facilitating. So facilitation of a conversation is placing yourself outside the conversation to hopefully steer and guide it for equal participation in psychological safety. And this is something I find. Because, again, so many producers aren't really given a toolkit. It's just like, this is what I learned on the job, or when I went to this PMI certification, the word facilitation never came up. You know, but you have to be able to, all endeavors, all groups of humans, but I find video game development to be a very pronounced and vivid version of this, where the range of personalities... The range of personalities and communication styles is amazingly diverse. And so you have to steer a conversation to have the super outgoing and outward people not dominate and blow the conversation away. And you have to get the more introverted, reserved, and internal processors to not withhold their information, because like, this doesn't feel safe. And a simple thing, I learned this from a counselor years ago. he would do these sessions, and he had just a simple question, nothing too intellectually sophisticated or anything. He would, after a conversation had gone for a while, he would say, "Well, we've heard from our external processors. Now, for you internal processors, you've been sitting here like taking all this in and mulling it over with your own thoughts. Like, we'd love to hear from you all." And actually, using this in a video game setting, Christopher Wynn.
Yeah.
So before he became a dev manager, producer, he was QA, and he was on a team, and that I produced, and we were in a retrospective, and we got to a point where it's like, all right, well, so those of you who really process things more externally and audibly, with us have weighed in. Some of you who internalize more and are, you've been thinking all this over and processing this and taking in all these inputs. We'd love to hear, I'd love to hear, have some of you contribute. And Chris, I can remember a couple of occasions where a long discussion would happen and he would say, "Well, what I'm seeing here is this." And it was amazing how it helped some of the external processors see how much they were pushing their stance, but how maybe that wasn't, maybe a bit more compromise actually was a better direction. Mm-hmm. Now, if me as the producer, if I had pushed for that, if I had tried to say, "Nobody's listening to Chris," then they'd be like, "Cool, task boy," it's that I'm inserting myself, right? I'm becoming the conduit. But if you can just facilitate and try to make space and draw people out, then that natural interaction that needs to happen between the persons has the opportunity to happen, as opposed to you trying to, jam it, force it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's a big part of building psychological safety in teams is helping conversations and people who have got usually pretty good reasons for either trying to dominate and drive a conversation or, like, I am only speaking if I absolutely have to.
Mm-hmm. It was not 2 days ago. I was in a meeting with one of my clients. They're working on abilities for a character. And there's the owner. There was me. There was another designer, right? And a third and a fourth person. And the four of us just were going back around and going over this doc and throwing all our opinions out there. And it was like, and then the owner was like, "All right, good. We've got a solution here. Let's end this meeting." And I was like, well, hold on a second. We've got four people who haven't spoken in the last 20 minutes. Let's just, I just want to say this right now. Mm. We have a plan. We like it. So it can't be worse than the plan we have now, right? But if you have any crazy idea, any wild thing that's on your mind, just throw it out here. Let's just hear it and see if there's something you've got going on, And one guy kind of just is like, recap what you said. And I think it's otherwise good. Cool. No problem. He was on board. And another guy was like, "Well, I had this different idea, but I didn't say anything because I thought it was a little too weird." And then explained this chain of actions. And then we just sat there and we're like, "Oh, this is totally better than what we had come up with in the first place." And we were like, "Oh, we should absolutely do that." And he was like, "Oh, really? Like, yeah, that's brilliant. It takes all the things we were describing, but you thought of one little twist on it that made it all kind of pull together. We should absolutely do this." And if we had just ended the meeting, who knows if he had brought it up later, maybe he would have forgotten. Maybe he would have just not even felt it was okay for him to contribute that idea. And that's not what you want in any team.
Mm-hmm. Not at all. Mm-hmm. So, all right. I am curious. If you'll indulge me, I love to, for people who haven't been immersed in, production and, maybe, and some of this stuff may be, things that are hearing or hearing talked about in this way for the first time. I'm always fascinated and curious by, what things are you wondering or questions might you have that we haven't talked about that this might be making you wonder, thinking like, "Well, I wonder what about this?" Or if there's nothing, that's cool. But I love, sometimes I get just some of the most fascinating questions from people that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just, when we talk about these kinds of things, I feel like it's often very much in the abstract and sort of generalized. And You've been very specific, which I appreciate, but still, I assume, you're coming to work every single day, and a lot of what you described seems like stuff that can be completed pretty quickly. Like the exercise that we did, obviously we didn't make a completed game, but I guess what I sort of wonder is, what is happening just on a daily basis? Like, what is your routine that you do to maintain this?
See, this I love these. I love this. So it's true. And when you know when we're in conversations like this, it, you know, there's it can feel very you know when you're producing a podcast or a video conversation like this. You know, if you have examples that are too overwrought or seem to go on too long, that can, it feels like, oh, this is not going to be satisfying content. Or but also. And so we do tend to like, all right, let's have things that are self-contained that could fit within this, you know, within what we have in mind. But you ask a fantastic question. So I'll try to give like a really, like a, just a couple of minute, like, here's what it's like. So in the past 9 years for me has been an experiment. I've been working on the inside of companies. As you know, a producer or you know, director, internal, both in games, out of games. But prior to that, I consulted doing that. You know, I was fully independent as a consultant for 8 years when I transitioned out of software engineering full time into product development. And the so my setting when I'm consulting with folks versus when I'm working on the inside, it's a bit different because with consulting, I'm helping them do these things. Versus, you know, on the inside. But so let's use the on the inside. So in the last few places I've been, the smallest group, that the smallest development team that I've been working with is 200 people.
Wow.
In the last 9 years. But more of them were in the 800 getting up to, you know, 1,200 people.
So I guess it just takes a lot of time just to talk to each individual person.
This is the importance in scaling this. Is you have to get a group of philosophically aligned people in the production discipline and begin to build this out and distribute. You have to teach and empower them to then go do these things. So what I'm typically doing is building that team, ensuring that their workload is such that they can do this in the way that we want them to do. This is, you know, I talk to them. This is the experience you're supposed to be creating for these development teams. And if you feel, and I'll get, and some people are like, well, this takes more time. In Jira, I could just do this. That's, your goal is not to master Jira. Your goal is to have good team interactions. And what you're talking about in Jira and having people communicate through subtasks is the opposite of the kind of an interaction that I want people to have. And so
Jira, for those who don't know, is a Trello-like project management software for assigning tasks.
Yes,
marketing's complete.
If Trello grew up, got a mortgage, started to have knee trouble, that is what Jira is.
That's Jira.
Yeah.
Got it.
So, and so I am usually working with the team stewards who are working directly with these teams and making the rounds, as it were, of sitting in on their, when they plan a development cycle or when they're having a retrospective, to observe and then give feedback. And I, when I'm in there observing, the agreement I set with the group is I'm here mostly just to observe and see how things are going. I'm not going to weigh in on the conversation or any of that, but by the same token, I don't want it to be weird. If there's something you want to ask me, you can ask me as the team, if you want to ask me. And so it's observing, providing feedback, and just replicating the approach to the craft that I developed over the years in more people, because that's what you have to do. Because when you have 35 development teams shipping a game in, you know, 5 regions around the world in 15 languages, you are not going to one person anything. You know, you've got to build out and scale. So a lot of my time is spent working with the people who need to now go do this with all these mini teams, but also focusing a lot on at the level above that, when we're bringing the effort of giving group of teams together, making sure that the way we talk about that is as clear and concise and accurate as it needs to be. Because as you scale all of this, the delicacy and precarious nature of how you roll up that information and take what's actually, you know, level of effort and approach, provide that to leadership, and then ensure that leadership is taking that in to say, okay, well, based on that information, we need to adjust our strategy and direction in these ways, and ensuring that that direction flows back down to teams with enough context to know, well, what does it mean? What does it mean when you said we have to have multiplayer? Or what does it mean when you say we have to be best in class co-op? That's a bullet point. I don't know what to do with that on my team. So I spend a lot of time trying to ensure that the context is flowing bidirectionally.
That makes sense. Well, Barry, I so appreciate all the wisdom that you've imparted today. I feel like I've learned so much from talking to you.
It's a blast.
It has been a blast talking to you. So thank you so much. If you would like to share your YouTube channel or your website or anything like that, I can link to it if you want to.
Yeah, I can send that stuff over. BarryHawkins.com is the site, but I'll provide you a list of links. And yeah, I have stuff on YouTube as well as on my site for free to help people with some of this stuff. And absolute pleasure speaking with y'all. And Alex, it's so good to see you. I can't wait
to
so
good to see you
again in person.
Oh my God, I can't wait until this stuff opens up again. I have one last thought I'd like to share.
Yeah.
So what I think a lot of people don't know is actually Barry is one of the mentors who led to me doing consulting on my own. And so you actually gave me a book, a couple of books. One of them was Secrets of Consulting by Gerald Weinberg. Another was Going It Alone, which is a fantastic read. And I just wanted to let you know that it was maybe 3 or 4 days ago, I actually handed that copy of that book that you handed me down to someone else who was about to get started in their own journey.
I just wanted
to thank you for that.
It is my pleasure. I tell you, talking about the things that you've worked on and those sorts of things, I am super thankful for all the things that I've gotten to work on in games and outside of games. But for me, the most fulfilling work experience is investing in other people and seeing that investment return both in those individuals, but then also what you see them do with other folks. So my absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you everyone for watching. I hope you have a great rest of your day. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.